Hey, before we get into the episode, we need to talk about the recent horrific tragedies that occurred over the last 2 weeks that were directly caused by gun violence. Honestly, it's disgusting to live in a country where some dudes feel emboldened to take out their frustrations from having a bad day by murdering innocent bystanders. Here at Sit Still, Look Opinionated, we stand with the American, Asian, and Pacific Islander community, and we would like to take a moment of silence to honor the 8 people who were murdered in Atlanta, as well as the 10 people who were murdered in Boulder. Thanks for that. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated. I'm your host, Claire Malky. Just like that refreshing first sip of a Starbucks hibiscus and passion fruit lemonade. A little basic, but refreshing. Last Friday, I took the day off because, unlike the Instagram algorithm that targets anthropology ads to me, I needed to remind myself that I'm a human and not an internet cyborg. I planned this grand adventure to go skiing in Wisconsin. Because what's more life-affirming than risking my entire existence to propel myself down a mountain? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. For a little bit of context, the weather in Illinois on this Friday in March was extremely lovely. Like Meghan and Harry's wedding the moment before their lives went to shit, lovely. So I set out on my quest. Me, the GPS, and the skis I barely know how to use, and I hit the open trail. Being the responsible driver that I am, with my eyes always on the road, I casually glanced at my phone and saw a notification that the ski resort might be closed by the time I arrive. Okay, don't panic. I mean, Google could be wrong. Like, which one of us has opposable thumbs? To prove my dominance over technology, I dialed the ski resort. Again, a very safe driver over here. And spoke to a friendly employee who informed me that they were, in fact, closed and to check back next weekend. But I don't have next weekend, I thought. I only have today. I could barely believe this employee just thought I had free will in my day-to-day life. Shouldn't they know I'm surgically connected to my desktop? I can't just unplug. That's not how this works. This isn't the Matrix. Unless this is the Matrix, and I have no idea how to get that blue pill, so we're basically back to square one. I was now quite literally driving with no direction. So I did what any responsible basic bitch would do and went to the closest Starbucks to cure my heartbreak with a brown sugar oat milk latte. Also, I could finally let loose that pee I'd been holding in since Chicago. For the rest of the day, I drove around a suburb called Arlington Heights. And honestly, there's nothing more cathartic than driving with the windows down and blasting the song Roses by the band Camino, now readily available on Spotify and all other streaming platforms. I'm not going to pretend that Friday was some magical experience and I learned a bunch of lessons. All I learned was that Arlington Heights has 3 targets within 5 miles of each other. And yes, I went to all of them, and yes, it was still better than my 9-to-5. The following Monday, I logged into my email when something outside caught my eye. Snow. It was then I was reminded that I really am human because that is the most fucking human thing that could actually have happened. But hey, at least I have my Starbucks. We have got a great show in store for you all today. Of course, we've got our breaking news headlines, our delightful sketches, and the one and only Howard Johnson is on the show. Make sure you stay tuned. Right now, I'm drinking the aforementioned brown sugar oat milk latte. Mmm, delish. Grab your drink and let's get started. Next, this week's headlines. Joe Biden has come out in support of changing the filibuster. Ted Cruz has come out in support of going to Dave & Buster's. Bars are opening up across the nation, but without stocking a key product, alcohol. Wait a minute, said Jamba Juice. Reports show that Biden's stimulus package includes the largest ever aid to public transit. The money is said to go to literally anything but the poop car. Officials are raising alarms that more has to be done to prevent the next meat shortage. Their biggest obstacle? Men's egos. North Korea demanded the U.S., quote, not cause a stink ahead of military exercises on the peninsula. This was code for, we know it's a new administration, but it's war if Rudy Giuliani shows up. We're all gonna die. Since being closed in April, the Met Opera offered to pay their musicians half of their regular salaries, but the only one that accepted was the Triangle Guy. Because when you can afford to live on the Upper West Side for tapping a piece of bent metal for a living, you're already counting your blessings. No comment from the guy who waves a stick around. That thing doesn't even make a sound. Thousands took to the streets across Australia on Monday to protest violence and discrimination against women. Looks like the male legislators got to start blowing their own didgeridoos. Google has gotten into sleep surveillance. So now it knows when you're sleeping and when you're awake. And when you've bought something at 2 a.m. when you were high. Between this and Amazon, things aren't looking too good job-wise for Santa. French bulldogs are now the second most popular canine breed in the world, losing once again to retrievers. Sorry, Huskies, that's gotta be rough. Cafes across Dubai have started serving coffee and other cold drinks in baby bottles. The trend was immediately banned by local authorities. Cafe patrons will respond after nappy time. Over one-third of Republicans are saying they will not take the COVID vaccine, raising their risk of catching a more deadly strand of the disease. To which the Democrats responded, okay. In a TV interview, Trump called on supporters to get vaccinated. Unfortunately, they didn't see it because it coincided with reruns of Duck Dynasty. Delivery trucks are going electric, so get ready for a whole new form of email. The IRS pushed back the deadline to file taxes to May 17th. Dear God, please, please, nobody ask Justin Timberlake when he's going to be doing his taxes. It's gonna be May. No. It is not gonna be May. May 17th. Do your taxes. Oumuamua, our solar system's first known interstellar visitor, has now gone past the orbit of Uranus. When it exited the boundaries of our observational power, astronomers noted how smoothly it moved. NASA, they put the lax in galaxy. A Tesla in self-driving mode hit a state trooper's vehicle in Michigan. Tesla's spokesperson said the car was driving well under the legal limit of malware. Conservatives seized on Biden tripping as he walked up the steps to Air Force One. The Secret Service says he tripped on the mic he dropped after vaccinating 100 million people in only 58 days. A volcano causing thousands of earthquakes in Iceland finally erupted. An unusual amount of smoke is in the air because it needed a cigarette after Greenland spent the night. Half of all adults in the UK have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. The other half still thinks the British monarchy serves a purpose. A total of 9 women have accused Governor Cuomo of sexual misconduct. Apparently he has a punch card and only needs one more to be president. More than 5,000 children are in CPD custody, and no, this time we're not talking about the insurrectionists. Last year, this time, Australia was on fire. This year, this time, Australia is underwater. In 2 years, this time, Australia will be the new Avatar. As vaccines have become available, some normal activities like taking vacations have returned for people ages 65 and up. Looks like there's a whole new meaning to Senior Week. Spring break just got a whole lot saggier. With the rise of online stock trading, some Americans use their $1,400 checks to buy into the online market. Because nothing stimulates the economy more than free money to gamble. I mean invest. The pandemic is causing ongoing delays with the mail. In response to this, the U.S. Postal Service announced, "Have a little patience, Christopher, your fucking ripstick is on the way. Have you heard our slogan? There's nothing in there about a goddamn pandemic. We are doing the best we can." Jeez. To get students safely back to school, experts suggest ventilation through open windows. This is not only good news for schools, but also for any classroom pet hamsters looking to pull a Finding Nemo. And that's this week's headlines.
While you're at work doing God knows what, they'll come over and walk your dogma.
Oh, hey there, little buddy. You must be right-wing dogma. Ready for your walk? I bet you're all bark and no bite. Let's get this leash on. Come on. I know those squirrels look tasty, but don't go try chasing them, you hear? So your top dog was kicked off social media, huh? Must be a rough time for you. Get it? You hate it, but social media companies are privately held. Imagine your pee and poo is conservative misinformation. It's the same as that owner's fence protecting from poo and pee, which kills grass the same way dangerous statements poison minds. Oh, look! Hey there, neighbor!
You keep that dog away from my yard and my social security!
Okay. Back to censorship.
I said social security!
Fuck you!
Oh, you two. Now, if the president can formally address the nation at his little old leisure, is it really censored? Can't you just do your business on another patch of grass? What's that, bud? Do you really want to go the easy route and have government regulate the content of private companies just because you don't have control? Weren't you warned when the Supreme Court heard conservative back cases involving a gay wedding cake? Imagine if cats got to dictate the terms of dogs' lives. What I'm trying to say is, don't force your beliefs on society with government as the sole arbiter. The precedent set could backfire when political winds shift. I didn't see you there, fellow dogma walker. What is this cute thing?
Left-wing dogma. The thing won't stop yapping about yoga and oat milk.
Yeah, we were just about to go over how speech and conduct are two different things. And incitement, like biting, isn't protected by the First Amendment.
Ugh, good luck with that. If I have to hear another sermon about veganism from this skinny bitch, I'm done.
Oh, look! They're sniffing each other's butts.
Aw, I smell a cure for Congress brewing! See ya.
Bye. Look, right-wing dogma. I know it's not easy, but we live in a democracy. Even people you presume to hate have equal protection under the law, you little rascal. Well, look at that. We're back. Here's a treat. And remember, the only real way to ban the speech you don't like is with better speech.
While you're at work doing God knows what, they'll come over and walk your dogma.
From all of us here at Dogma Walkers, don't forget to spay or neuter your dogmas.
All of you, but after a year of quarantining, my sleep schedule is still all out of whack. I've tried everything. Sleepy time tea, melatonin, heck, CBD didn't even work. But now, I'm taking the plunge into alternative relaxation methods. Here to talk about her sleep techniques, YouTube sensation ASMR Addie.
Hi, Claire. I hope you don't mind. I brought my favorite candle.
Okay, sure. So, Addie, you're the expert. What the heck is ASMR?
That's what this candle is for, Claire. ASMR is exactly this. Hear all these sounds I'm making. They should be causing you to feel a buzzing sensation in your psyche. And begin to open up your chakras.
Oh, Addie, we just met. I'm not really sure I'm ready to open.
Claire, I'm flattered, but no. ASMR uses the sounds of everyday objects to soothe and lull you into a deep sleep.
Oh, phew. I was getting pretty nervous there for a second.
Don't worry, hon. I've been told I have that effect on people.
Oh, okay. So what exactly is the candle for again?
Listen. Do you feel that tingling sensation behind your brain, deep, deep inside your aura?
I guess?
That's ASMR! And now...
Do you feel my voice crawl inside your earballs and massage your soul into a tranquil sleep?
That almost sounds like you're describing murder.
That's ASMR! Actually, I found this envelope in your mailbox. We will be using it for our next exercise.
What? Addie, you opened my mail?
That's ASMR! Envelope is a medical bill for your last two COVID tests.
Excuse me?
And it looks... And it looks like they didn't take your insurance. You owe $393.75. That's ASMR!
Fuck it, I'm taking an Ambien. ASMR Addy, everyone! Hey, listener! Thanks for listening so far. We honestly couldn't have gotten to the place we are without all of you. And whenever a listener DMs us on Instagram or even tells us in person how thankful they are, it really means the world to us. That being said, if you actually want to make an impact on how the show is performing, we would love it if you could give us a quick rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Yes, we know Spotify is easier, but the review on Apple Podcasts helps with the all-divine powerful algorithm. Thanks in advance. And if you'd want to help even more, then head over to patreon.com/sitstill to join our opinionated family. If any of you saw my Instagram post, Mike and I are in a competition to see who can gain the most Patreon subscribers. And I really, really like winning. So help a girl out and check us out on Patreon. Thanks to our patrons, Anthony, Laura, and Andy. Y'all are the bee's knees. Up next, my interview with Howard Johnson. All right, for today's Chicago Artist Spotlight, we have Howard Johnson. Thank you for being on Sit Still, Look Opinionated, Howard.
Thanks for asking, Claire. This is great.
I'm super excited to interview you and talk about your work in Chicago and the comedy scene. For any of our listeners who don't know you, can you talk about your background a little bit and who you are?
I will. Yes. I'm at the moment, I'm running the Comedy Lab, which is a TV comedy writing class that you are intimately familiar with, I think. Mm-hmm. Yes. But before that, I always tell my students, so this is going to sound very familiar to you. I always tell my students that my background is in improv comedy and the I.O. in particular, and it's also in Monty Python. So I grew up literally with the Monty Python guys. I ran away to join the circus when they were in Tunisia filming Life of Brian, and I never looked back, and I'm still hanging out with the guys and working with them and all of that fun stuff again. But I also, I know I look so young, Claire, so you're going to be astonished when I tell you this, but I'm actually so old that I was in the Improv Olympic before it was the I.O. I was on the very first house team of the Improv Olympic. And I always told my students, if you go downstairs at the I.O. and look at the most yellowed, beat up, crappiest team photo there, that was the Barons Barracudas. That was my team, the very first one. Of course, the I.O. is closed now, so we can't do that joke anymore. But it was fun while it lasted. And I was in the first house, on the first house team. I was in a show that Del directed, Del Close, and I wrote a book, co-wrote a book with Del Close and Sharna Halpern called Truth in Comedy, which if you took classes at the I.O., you probably had rammed down your throat. And Del was one of my best friends. And when I was living in Chicago, he lived just down the street from me. We hung out a lot together. He was my teacher, he was my director, and he was my friend and my neighbor and all kinds of things. And I wrote a biography of Del after he passed away. And that is somewhere on Amazon, I think. The book is sold out, but you can do a Kindle book of it if you're really interested in hearing it. I'm really giving you a long answer here, aren't I? You're not having to ask very many questions today.
Hey, but that makes my job easier, so all good.
Makes my job harder, though, because I've got to entertain you as well as your listeners. That's all
very
right.
Very true. Here for. Yes. All right. So you mentioned Monty Python and getting started with all of them. Is that sort of how you first got introduced to comedy, or where did you discover comedy?
Well, I discovered comedy just, you know, through TV growing up, Laurel and Hardy, The Three Stooges, I was a big fan of the classic comedies back then. Loved comedy. Really, more than anything else, I was probably a fan of Laurel and Hardy. And I always thought that, you know, if I was living in the late 20s, I would love to be able to hang out on the set and watch Laurel and Hardy work and, you know, take notes on them and just see how they did what they did. And then I realized that's not going to happen because I am way too young for that. And what I did do, however, was I watched PBS one Sunday night. It was one of, if not the very first episodes of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And I saw this show and I recognized something in this that's like really clever and fresh and original and innovative. And I was right. I've been wrong before, but I was definitely right about that, about comedy. And I realized that, you know, if I was younger, or if I was much older, rather, I would have liked to have hung out with Laurel and Hardy. Instead, you know, I'd like to hang out with Monty Python. And it happened. It happened, Claire.
Mm-hmm.
And that became a defining moment of my life that, you know, literally changed your life. You know, people always talk about that, you know, what changed your life? And, well, I can tell you, my life changed the first time I saw Monty Python, and I did a lot of things. I did a Monty Python fanzine, which nowadays I would have done a Python website probably. But I was one of the very first Monty Python fans. And so when I did this Monty Python fanzine, I wrote I wrote the whole thing, you know, assembled it and sent it off to London. And I got back these wonderful glowing letters of praise from all of the Pythons. Just saying, oh, what a wonderful job. You know, we all flunked the quiz, because there was a Monty Python quiz in there. And I realized, and what happened was they were having a meeting Python meeting because it was not long before they did Life of Brian. And so they passed around copies of my fanzine. And then at the end of his letter, Michael Palin wrote, "If you're ever in London, be sure to look me up." And I booked a trip to London that next week. And
oh
the rest is history. Yeah, nowadays it would be called stalking. I don't encourage it. But it worked for me.
That's really exciting. I mean, what was that like getting on a plane to London and not really knowing what you were getting into?
Well, see, what happened was I booked the trip to London, and I had been kind of in touch, you know, by mail with some of the Pythons. And so they kind of knew of me. John Cleese dropped a 20-pound note in an envelope and said, send me copies of this fanzine. So what happened was I got into London. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I went by the Python office, and it was closed, but one of the wardrobe people was there getting ready for, you know, the Life of Brian shoot. And mm-hmm. The only address I actually had was John Cleese's because it was on his stationery. So I foolishly decided, well, I'm only here for 6 days. I was there for 1 week because I was working a day job at the time. I had just gotten out of college, and I decided foolishly to go over to John Cleese's place, and at least my excuse is delivering these fanzines that he wanted. So I went over there, and I still remember his place was in Holland Park in the West End or West Side. And I walk up the stairs, or a lot of stairs leading up to his front door. And I knock on the door, and the door opens, and John was even another step higher than me, and looked out and looked down at me. I said, "Yes." And I said, "John, I'm Howard Johnson." I started to say, "You know, I brought these fanzines for you." And it just, this big grin comes over his face. And he says, "Howard Johnson, come in, come in." And he invited me in. And I remember he poured me a scotch. We sat down and talked for a while. And he just said, "Okay, what do you want to do? You're only in London for 1 week. What do you want to see? Who do you want to meet?" And I said, "Well, I want to meet all the guys." And so he gave me all the addresses and the phone numbers and everything. Then he sent me over to Graham Chapman's house. And Graham was in North London, up in Highgate. And long story short, Graham put me up at his place for a week. Now, Eric Idle was in L.A., but I got to see all the other guys, including Terry Jones. And Terry was on holiday, off in Wales with his family. But Terry said, "Come on out, you know, come on out and spend the night." So I jumped in the train and went out to Wales. And Terry and I went hiking through the hills and stopped at this pub where everybody's speaking Welsh. And the whole week I was there, everybody was talking about, yeah, Life of Brian. Oh, they were so excited, you know, there's a script. We were rewriting scenes and all. And so I read the script when I was at Terry's place out in Wales. And, you know, it was just great stuff. I saw all the costumes. I saw the props. I saw all of this stuff. And that's all that anybody was talking about during the week I was there. So when I got back, I realized, boy, this is like my current life's dream, is to like work with Monty Python on their movie set. And so I contacted the office in London and, you know, asked if there were any jobs on the set or anything like that. And they said, why don't you just come on over and we'll find something for you to do. So, So I hitchhiked to Tunisia, as John says, and just worked with the Pythons for a couple of months while they were filming Life of Brian. You know, if that's not a life-changing experience, I don't know what is, especially for a comedy geek.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, and John is still one of my best friends today. I see him often. And and whenever any of the other guys had traveled through Chicago, I would end up getting together with them. And, Graham used to travel through Chicago a lot, Graham Chapman. I remember taking him to the I.O. Graham used to pass through Chicago a lot of adventures with Graham in Chicago. Terry Jones, I produced a couple of shows with Terry Jones, including one in Chicago, where we would show Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and then I would do a Q&A with Terry in the audience. And I remember I brought Terry into the city. I can't remember what he was doing there. We stopped by one of Dell's workshops, and Dell was having a class, conducting a class. And Dell said, "Well, I'll meet you next door, you know, as soon as my class is over." So we all sat down, we had a nice big lunch. And then Terry and I had to leave, and we gave Del a ride home. And it was toward the end for Del. And so Del got a chance to meet Terry, because Del passed away about 4 or 5 months after that, because his emphysema was so bad. But it was really nice to see Terry and Del comparing notes, just about people they knew in common and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Graham, on the other hand, Graham got to meet Del much earlier than that. I brought Graham into town, and we were doing a show called Honor Finnegan versus the Brain of the Galaxy. The Barons Barracudas were doing this show that Del directed, you know, and I co-wrote with some of the other guys. And so Graham was in town. Graham came two nights, actually. He came the first night to see the show. Then the second night, he was doing a show at the Park West. And after that show, he ran over to Cross Currents, which is where we were doing our show. And after that, we ended up going back to my place for this impromptu party. So it was Del Close and Graham Chapman and Bill Murray and some of the other improvisers that were out there. One of the better parties I've ever had, in this little rat hole apartment on North Race Scene. nobody cared. It was great. We all just sat around and just told stories. So anyway, I seem to be monopolizing the conversation here, Claire.
No, I just imagine what it would be like to be a fly on the wall in those moments, because I'm not from Chicago. I didn't really know much about comedy before I even really moved here. And I got a job at the Second City working on the night staff because I wanted to be around theater people. And then I started to learn about, you know, all the Second City history and about IO and the Annoyance and this blooming community that exists here. And I want to ask you a little bit about, like, how has Chicago comedy changed over the years or grown, or what has your experience been like being such a staple in Chicago?
Well, when I started out in Chicago, long before you were born, I did what most people did back then. I took classes at Second City. Mm-hmm. They had like a training center there. The training center was Don DiPolo. And there were 3 8-week classes. That was it. That was the only thing that, yeah, Second City eventually wised up and realized we could make money if we really ran this school.
Yeah.
But that's where I started out. And Donnie DiPolo was wonderful. Then I started asking around, you know, where else should I go to study? You know, you're only doing 3 6-week or 3 8-week classes. And so there's this guy you ought to meet, Del Close. And at that time, you got to realize the comedy scene was almost nothing. It was Second City. It was a Chicago Comedy Showcase. There were a couple of 2 or 3 other places and a few groups that were really loose knit kind of places. There was not a lot going on in the improv world at that time. It was, you know, but we didn't know any better, you know, because there weren't that many people doing it at the same time either. So we didn't know what we were missing. I had heard of Del before. His name was in the paper a lot, in the gossip columns to plug shows and things like that. Friend of mine, mutual friend of ours, Del's and mine, named Mike Gold, used to run, he would call them Saturnalia parties every December, a couple of weeks before Christmas. And he'd invited me, and I went there 1 year, and Del didn't make it. Del was doing a Christmas carol at the Goodman. The following year, I went back to the party, it was still going on. I went to Mike's party, and finally, later in the evening, Del and Sharna showed up, and I just kind of introduced myself a little bit, or Mike might have introduced me, I can't remember. And we started talking with Del and with Sharna, and I said, I'm a star. I write for Starlog magazine, and I do a little bit of writing for Fangoria magazine. Fangoria magazine. Oh my God, Sharna, this is a Fangoria writer. And so Del immediately loved me because I wrote for Fangoria. You know, I can write a lot for Fangoria. It was enough. And I said, well, you know, I'm studying with Don DiPolo now, but I'd really love to, take some classes with you. And Sharna, of course, jumps right up. All right, yes. Well, the next session starts on January 6th. Yes, if you show up 7 o'clock at the cross. So she did the usual Sharna thing. She, you know, the business stuff, and got me involved. And I started going to this little rat hole club on North Wilton Street, which was right by Belmont and Sheffield. Mm-hmm. And I went to the first class, and again, I don't know if it was a life-changing experience then, but it became one, just yeah. hanging out there. This, I didn't know this at the time, but this was a really new thing. It was like the IO, or the Improv Olympic, as it was back then, was less than a year old. And so at that time, they would get students in for like 8-week periods, and it would kind of rotate. That's where I first met Bob Odenkirk, was when mm-hmm. Bob was taking classes with Dell. And Bob and I became friends. He was, you know, so many of the people just rotated in and out. But I was there for about a little over a year, before all the people that I eventually came to work with in our own improv group came along. That's when David Pasquazi started, and Joel Murray. They both came the same night. I remember that very well. And all of the people in the Barons Barracudas, the first iteration of Barons Barracudas, started then. And we started doing shows 2 or 3 months into it, maybe April or May of that year. And it became a big thing. Everybody started coming to Cross Currents to watch what we were doing. Mm-hmm. We started doing the shows I think, Tuesday and Saturday nights. And Second City had just started the ETC Theater, mm-hmm. but they didn't do shows on Tuesday. So all of the people from Second City would come up to Cross Currents to watch our Tuesday improv sets. And some of them would start working with us. And, you know, people like Bonnie Hunt and Mike Myers, you know, coming up and improvising with us, and we'd be doing sets together. It became a bigger community, I think, mm-hmm. because of what Dell and Sharna were doing with the IO. And it was growing, you know, it grew incrementally slow. But it yeah. grew, and you could see everything kind of starting to slowly build on itself, mm-hmm. because it was the IO and it was Second City. And one of Dell's students, friend of mine, named Mick Napier, started up. And, you know, Mick was in the Honor Finnegan show with the rest of us, and Mick, shortly after that, went off and started The Annoyance. Mm-hmm. I was the very first show with The Annoyance that they did. I was in charge of the meat puppets. It was kind of similar to another improv that I had done earlier. So it was part of Splatter Theater.
And, wow, which is still was going on, like even up until last year for a while.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing about Chicago improv. I mean, people come and go, but it's really a community. Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of, at that point, at least for the first few years, everybody knew everybody else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was, what do I want to say? You know, everybody was friends. Everybody yeah. knew each other. Everybody hung out, and everybody supported everybody else. And I think it's largely still true that way.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we, in this year, you know, 2020, 2021, you know, the future, improv mm-hmm. and comedy, and it's obviously very different because we can't be in the same space, and that, you know, what comes with that nature. What in your eyes do you think comedy will look like going forward? And would you have any advice or like words of wisdom for anyone who wants to start doing comedy in this day and age?
I could give them advice, but they wouldn't listen anyway, because if they want to do it bad enough, they're still going to do it. They're going to find mm-hmm. a way to do it. And God love them. They should be doing that. Yeah. Cause if you've got that desire, that burning desire, you can't not do comedy, and you'll find a way to do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When the world shut down in March of 2020, nobody knew what it was going to turn into. Nobody dreamed it was yeah. going to be, you know, people were going to be out for that long. Nobody knew it was going to result in Second City being sold and the IO closing and being sold. And, you know, nobody knew that was going to happen. So, and people naturally started experimenting. You know, they're trying to do improv online, which was easier said than done. I was teaching the comedy lab classes, and I got very, very lucky because the comedy lab, TV comedy writing is easy to teach online, and it's easy to study it and learn it. And I always said my students, you know, since the pandemic started, were the smartest students out there, because at the end of the pandemic, you know, if you guys take my classes, if you guys, you know, show up and do all the work, at the end of the pandemic, you guys are going to have packets. You're going to have scripts under your arm. You're going to know how to use them to get an agent. So when this pandemic ends, you got a major head start on everybody else in the comedy scene. I guess that turned into a commercial for the comedy lab, didn't it? But it's true. You know, people that really want to do this are going to find a way to do it. Do I think the comedy scene is going to change? Yeah, absolutely, because it changes all the time. So, but, you know, what is it going to be? That's the question. It's going to be different. It's not going to be as different as some people think it's going to be, but it's not going to be exactly the way it was either when it came back. So I don't know. I'm anxious as everybody else to find out. Mm-hmm. But one thing I know is people are still going to be doing it.
Yeah.
So
for sure.
Yeah. So good luck to them.
So burning question from many listeners, I'm sure. Do you think IO is going to make a comeback at all, or is it going to be in any different iteration, or is that a closed chapter in Chicago?
The IO is not finished. The IO, I'm sure, is going to be back in some way, shape, or form. And I don't know what that's going to be. And I don't think Sharna Halpern knows what it's going to be. And it might or might not involve Sharna Halpern. It'd be nice if it involved me, but I understand, you know, things change too. So this is a really, really crazy time for Second City, for the IO, for the Annoyance, for comedy sports. Everybody's going through all of this. Mm-hmm. This is like the biggest shakeup there's been in comedy in Chicago in many decades. Second City, I don't know. Second City is a brand right now. And, you know, when you got financiers stepping in and buying the brands, what are they going to do with it? There's a lot of people that are very worried. Whether there's any reason to be worried, we don't know yet. So we'll see what Second City turns into. But Second City, keep in mind, doesn't own the building. Second City isn't the buildings. IO, Sharna Halpern, owns the building. So, you know, she's been paying taxes on this, you know, giant fortress on North Kingsbury throughout the whole pandemic. So what's going to happen? I don't know. But I'm sure she would love to do a similar thing to what Second City did. So but she does own the building. So that's good and it's bad. It's bad in the short term when you got to be paying taxes on it, but it's good in the long term if you want to sell it. Mm-hmm. And that area is very hot real estate wise. So nobody knows, Claire. I wish I could tell you the answers, but it's going to look different, but something's going to emerge from this. That'll be a little different, but it'll be still very cool because there's too many people that want to do this that are going to do what they have to do it.
Exactly. And it's been really a learning experience for me during the pandemic to have to shift the format of what I want my career to look like and trying out writing and, you know, taking new classes that I, you know, haven't had experience in. So shifting back to teaching in a way, what are some of your favorite parts about teaching comedy?
One of the things I love the most is the beginning of each term, meeting the classes for the first time. I never thought when this whole thing went under originally that, I'll teach this comedy writing online. And when I first got the thought, I guess, yeah, we could do it that way. Maybe we'll just try to figure it out. I only missed one weekend of classes when the whole pandemic hit. So I was lucky that way, but I had to figure out how to do it online. And so when I did that, I quickly realized I can do classes, not just for the people that are sitting around the table in this room. I can do classes for anybody in the world at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I love the most, the conglomeration of people from all across the U.S., from Canada, from South America, Europe, people everywhere. And it's just, it kind of blows the mind a little bit that I've got that many students from that many different places. I had a student ask me, well, you know, let's, you know, when we start doing this again, and we're all in the room, you know, when we all sit around the bar after, I'm like, well, wait a minute. Now, I don't know what I'm going to be doing, because that would mean I would lose so many students right now from all around the world. Anybody that's not in Chicago right now, I'm going to lose as a student if I do that. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll probably do some classes in person. I'll probably do some that are just online and just Zoom, because I love working with all these students from everywhere. And you look at it this way, there's so many students from so many different places, all in one place, all in one screen, that are doing these classes. You're never going to get a conglomeration of people like that put together again. Let's see what happens. They've all got different backgrounds. They've all got different experiences, because they've all grown up in all these different places in all kinds of different situations. Let's see what happens. Let's see what they can bring to the table. And it's always been cool every single time. So that's what I love the most about doing this. I had I'm luckier than almost anybody else during this pandemic, because I've been able to keep the classes going and expanding on them. So it's been good. I've been lucky.
Having taken your online classes, it has actually opened up my worldview too, as well, to hear people who English is not their native language to be writing comedy in English. And it really opened up my eyes to think, oh, what are the possibilities of working with English language and making comedy? And just hearing how people from around the world view Americans. And, you know, I can't help but just have my American worldview, because that's where I live. So taking your online classes was so incredibly rewarding, and I can't wait to take more of them.
Thank you so much, Claire. That's great to hear. Because I love doing the same thing. I love listening to the students from Europe, you know, students in Germany, Bulgaria, you know, Britain, Northern Ireland, all kinds of, you know, from everywhere, students from Brazil. And yeah, you get exposed to all these different points of view, and it only helps the comedy. I always worried, can you teach a guy who's, or a person who is English is not their first language, to do this stuff? And you can, you can up to a point. I mean, I've got Bulgarian students, and it depends on how good their English is. And if the ones with the English isn't that great, and they can read you lines, you just kind of assume, okay, this is a really good line in Bulgarian, you know, but they're having to translate it into English as a punchline. So it doesn't work as a punchline in English, but if you give them the general comedy rules, they'll figure out how to make that punchline work in Bulgarian.
Right. And I can totally, if that was my shoes, maybe if I were to write, you know, something that had a rhyme scheme in Spanish, it would obviously sound different than in English. So it's, yeah, I laud those people for taking your classes and working with a language that's not their own, which it's so amazing to watch those people do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. A year ago, if you would have told me I'd be doing this, I'd be teaching Bulgarian students, you know, I never would buy into that, but it happens, you know, it really is happening, and it's so cool to be able to do that. So, so I hope to keep doing this online and keep doing students all over as much as I possibly can, because it's really cool, because you learn so much. You know, big secret is I learn more from my students than they learn from me. That's a cliche, but it's freaking true. So, but don't tell anybody.
Oh yeah. Secret safe with us and all the listeners.
Good, good, good. All right.
So, Howard, if our listeners did want to take one of your classes or read one of your books to learn more about comedy, where could we direct them?
Funny you should mention that. There's this website, thecomedylab.net, thecomedylab. I didn't know this was going to be a spelling test. Thecomedylab.net. That's the place to go. We just started a new term last week, and I'm going to be putting classes up for registration pretty soon. Coming up for the third term of the year. Wow, that came fast.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be sure to put that in the show notes. And then in terms of if someone wants to work on their writing skills, do you have any like daily practices that you can suggest to people, or any little wisps of knowledge like that?
I will give you three words that are the most important things I can give a potential writer. Write every day. Mm-hmm. You've heard that before, apparently.
I have.
Yes. If you write every day, you're going to get better and better at it. You're going to exercise muscles that you haven't used before, or most students haven't used before. But the more you write, the more often you write, the better you're going to get at it. And, you know, and I tell my students too, look, if you write, you know, we do 8 weeks of classes. And I always tell them, write 1 2-line joke per day. That's all you need mm-hmm. to do. And at the end of the 8 weeks, if you do that, you're going to have 56 jokes. Now, half of those jokes might suck, but you've still got another half of them that might not suck. And if those don't suck, you're going to be able to do open mic nights. You're going to be able to do online open mics. And, you know, and that's how it can start. That's how it does start for a lot of people. You know, stand up is fun, but also writing scripts and writing sketches. Wow, it's a major accomplishment. I mean, there's nothing I like better than going to my spec script class, my sitcom spec script class, or my pilot presentation class, and going in there about week 5 or so. And the assignment is to write the first half of their first draft at that point. And they come in and they got these big grins on their faces. They can't freaking believe they've just written half of a spec script. And then the next week, they bring in the entire thing. And they've written this, you know, a 30-page sitcom spec script. I have to mention, obviously, the great Michael McCarthy. Michael is the one that created the whole Comedy Lab program. I couldn't be doing any of this if it wasn't for Michael. But Michael came up with the idea for this program, and he started it at the IO like 20 years ago or so. And that's the reason people are able to write a spec script in 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. People have never written anything before, never written anything more than 2 or 3 pages. But you can do it. It's not that difficult, thanks to Michael's method. Dear old Michael passed away just about a year ago. And Susan Messing passed the program to me and gave me the program. So bless both of them, because they're wonderful. Yeah, and I would not be talking to you right now if that had not happened.
And so, I'm so grateful for it. I can't wait to take the last two classes, and I'm really looking forward to when I can make those pilot and spec scripts happen, because I am very excited for them.
It's so much easier than you think it's going to be, too, Claire. That's the good thing about it. You will be so happy.
Yes.
You'll be joyous. You will come in, I finished this. I wrote a spec script. Yeah. But it's great, because it's, you know, most people think that's just this huge obstacle that you just can't get over. But it's not that difficult. Writing a good spec script might be a little more difficult. But the first step is just to write one. If you can write one and finish one, that's so huge. It'll just make you the happiest person in the world.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, in your opinion, could you describe how teaching comedy is different than performing comedy?
I can talk about that. I've done stand-up, I've done improv, I've acted in plays. They're all a little bit different, but it's all exercising that creative muscle and just massaging your ego a little bit. It's all fun. There's more pressure. The most pressure is on you when you do stand-up, because when you're doing stand-up, you got nobody else to blame. Mm-mm. Maybe a mic operator or something, or was it the soundboard, but that's about it. When you're improvising, if you're doing it right, you're playing, and it's great fun. But you're writing, kind of, when you're improvising. I mean, you try not to actually write when you're up there improvising, but to some extent, I suspect that tends to happen. But when I'm up there, or when I'm out there writing, you get to control everything. And everything is, well, the purest moment is when you get that idea in your head. You get that inspiration. You get an idea for a sketch or whatever. And that's as good as it gets. You get that pure idea and you tell somebody else and you start laughing together. And then you write it down on the paper and it's not quite as good. It kind of loses something. I think Kevin McDonald talked a little bit about this from Kids in the Hall when he spoke to some of my students last week. It kind of isn't quite as much fun when you write it down. It becomes a little more real and it becomes more work. And then you keep writing and rewriting and polishing and, you'll get it there. And it's a little more real when you see it on paper. When you're improvising, it's a lot more ephemeral. You know, it's gone when you're finished, right? When you're finished improvising the scene. So it's, they've both got their strengths and weaknesses. They're both very valid, however you want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing about at Second City, you know, the improv to sketch format is, I feel like sometimes it's like, oh, this was so great in this moment, let's bring it back. And you have to, rework it a little bit so you can find that moment. And that's something that I love about comedy and having my background is in acting. So to bring that into comedy, it's like, oh, bringing that discovery into every moment. And like, even if I know which direction the sketch is going in, it's like finding that energy on stage. So that's something that I've always noticed is different between the writing process and the performing process.
Yeah. It's when you're trying to transfer something from an improv to a written piece, sometimes it's better when you do it that way. Sometimes, not real often, but sometimes you can kind of recreate that lightning in a bottle. Mm-hmm. But it's tough.
Yeah.
There's some good teachers that are doing that. I think Norm Holly teaches that, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't taken any of his classes, but I think that's what that setup is like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the thing about improv is that if you're on a roll with the right people and the chemistry is good and it's a good night, you can't top that moment of discovery when mm-hmm. you discover something and the audience discovers it and that your fellow improvisers discover it with you. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And it happens sometimes, some nights, and some nights it doesn't.
Yeah.
But that's why it's called improv.
Yep. And it's going to be gone the next night.
yeah, absolutely. But it's huge fun. But so is writing. If you write something correctly, it's going to live forever if it's on the page.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, they both bring a different humanity out. You know, improv is in the moment and then it's gone. But then, writing is something that you create and you build and it can last forever. And someone in 100 years could read it, if it's a book or even a movie, I guess. There's movies that are, I guess, not 100 years old, but
Buster Keaton's movies still holding up.
Yeah.
Buster Keaton's silent films are 100 years old this year and they really work. Mm-hmm. So some of it do. Some of it does. Yeah. If it's done right, if it's done well enough, it can last. There was always this ongoing battle between Del Close and Bernie Solins, who was the producer at Second City for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And it was always about, Bernie always said improv was a tool for developing sketches. And they always said, no, it's an art form by itself. And they always went back and forth. And I think they'll probably won that particular battle as far as being its own thing. You just walk into any of those theaters we were talking about in Chicago when there's not a pandemic going on, and you'll discover it for yourself.
I guess there is that. There's one more question when you bring up improv as an art form. Can you talk a little bit about developing the Herald and that that process of creating that creating the Herald as a improv form?
Yeah, I can. Long form improv and the Herald were developed by the committee out in San Francisco about 67 or 68. Del was teaching out there. Alan Meyerson was director of the committee, and they were working on that. They all had this idea, what if we did a whole evening that was nothing but, one long improvisation? And they worked on that and developed it, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. Then Del ended up moving to Chicago after he left the committee, and that's one of the things that he wanted to focus on. And when he came back to Chicago, he started working at Second City. He started directing the shows there. This was back in the, you know, John Belushi days. And eventually, Wendell got fired from Second City for the second or third time. He ended up with Sharna Halpern, and they were trying to figure out, you know, what do we do? You know, and Del was not very interested in all of the Viola Spolin games. He knew him and he knew Viola, but he wasn't terribly interested in doing that. But Sharna was much more interested in the game work, and Del was much more interested in the scene work. And they kind of mashed them up together. Because the very first Heralds that we did were just that. They were, it was an old Spolin game, the Time Dash. And you would just do do games in between the different layers and levels of the scenes. And that's what we did when we were first starting this out with Del. We were like his little guinea pigs. And, well, let's try this. Let's see what happens if you do that. And that's what we did to come up with what ultimately was the basis for all of the long-form Herald stuff in Chicago that followed, I think. It was, you know, he gave us enough leeway, so we weren't locked into, you know, three scenes a game, three scenes a game. So we did a little more than that. We did, but that was the basis for everything that came after it.
Mm-hmm. That's, I've been going back through some of my books and, Truth in Comedy. I was looking through it a little bit earlier today and I was like, oh yes, the Herald. That's a long form that I haven't explored in, because I only got to level 3 at IO. So I didn't get to the performance level or anything yet, but you know, it'll come back in some way and I'll get my time.
Absolutely you will. Yeah, don't give up. Do it yourself if you have to. Just get up there and do it, because that day is coming and it'll probably be here sooner rather than later.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Howard. I really do appreciate your time. And I really can't wait for all of our listeners to listen in on all of this.
So,
well, Howard, this has been an amazing interview. Thank you so much for your time. And we'll be sure to put all of our links in the show notes for all of our listeners to find your classes.
Thank you, Claire. It's great to be here. I don't know what the hell Dritto's problem was. I'm going to have to work. Jeez.
I know, right?
But you more than carried his weight.
And that's all for today. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at sitstill_lookopinionated. And now on Twitter at sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you didn't hear that right, please write a review. Please, please, please write a review! This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and Claire Malky. And written by myself, Claire Malky, Michael Dritto, Fee Basanyavichis, and Gabriel Scavor. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. This program is partially supported by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. If you would like to support this podcast, please visit and subscribe to our Patreon page linked in the show notes. This podcast was recorded on the land of the Kickapoo, Peoria, and Potawatomi Nations. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. Oh, and don't forget, stay opinionated. Bye!